The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And oh my goodness, what do we have now? The voters have spoken on Super Tuesday, and it is What Do We Do Now Wednesday. For the Democrats, it just might be an easy coast to the convention. Hillary Clinton had some nice things to say about her rival Bernie Sanders. And when the count is finished, Hillary may have a solid lead in delegates and what looks like an unbreakable hold on the southern states. In a moment, former Congressman Barney Franks declares it's over for the Democrats. Clinton will be the nominee. That's coming right up. As for Donald Trump, his sweet victories in most of the Super Tuesday states seem to make a turning point for the candidate. Last night, it was Donald Trump, the quiet, measured billionaire, looking to find a proper tone to express the gravitas of the presidency he seeks after weeks of cat-clawing combat in those presidential debates.
I'm a unifier. I know people are going to find that a little bit hard to believe, but believe me, I am a unifier. Once we get all of this finished, I'm going to go after one person. That's Hillary Clinton, on the assumption she's allowed to run, which is a big assumption. I don't know that she's going to be allowed to run.
Pastor Mark Burns is an evangelical pastor in South Carolina who's voted in the past for Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, but not so much anymore.
I invite everyone that is here to help me elect the next president of the United States of America, Donald J. Trump. Shout Trump!
That's Pastor Burns introducing Donald Trump at a rally in Oklahoma City last week. He's been traveling around the country with the Trump campaign. He joins me now from South Carolina. Pastor Burns, welcome back. And what do you have to say?
Well, you know, we're really ecstatic and happy that Mr. Trump, he did really well on Super Tuesday, as expected. He does what he said he's going to do, which is he's going to win, and he's doing that winning.
Is that the idea? Win, and it really doesn't matter what Trump's life record is. You want a winner there in the White House.
Well, I really want somebody that you can trust in the White House, and that's really what's important. As a pastor, honesty is really is the top priority. Donald Trump has made it clear to us as evangelicals that we will have a friend in the White House. And so it's important when someone says that they don't come and just sing the hymnal songs and the Christian routine just to win over our votes, but actually keep to their word once they get into office. And we believe Donald Trump would do just that.
One of the things that Super Tuesday proves is that black votes are hugely important in the South, and that African Americans have voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton and look to vote overwhelmingly for Democrats in the general election. If that is the case in the fall, African Americans are going to be a very, very difficult constituency for Donald Trump to attract. How would he do that?
Well, I think it all starts to what really matters. When you paint the picture of not voting based off of feelings, but vote based off of facts, the fact is the African-American community, our community, my community, is one of the most deprived financially, economic groups there is in America. It's all about jobs and creating jobs. And I've spoken to many HBCU students who are in American, historically black college students, and no, they don't like the rhetoric that media has played out, that Donald Trump is just racist and Donald Trump is just separatist. But at the end of the day, in these conversations, they say, I would vote for Donald Trump because he's the one that is most likely to create jobs. And that's really where I'm at. And so Donald Trump is a unifier, and it's through economic development, through jobs.
But name one policy that Donald Trump has suggested that would do anything about that. He says the jobs will come back because I'm going to bring the companies back, but he doesn't say how he's going to do that.
Well, you know, he's also made it clear that he's surrounding himself around very, very smart business men and women. Donald Trump has made it clear there's some very smart business people that the government has not used. They've been using political hacks, as he called it, and not real people that can really bring a real change to America. And he's going to make sure he's surrounding himself around very smart people that has done deals for him and helped build his major company that he has, successful company that he has. He's bringing that same principle to the federal government.
So, Pastor, you believe that Donald Trump is authentic and you're trusting these jobs that will come to help African-Americans in the cities to Trump's business friends and billionaire friends who are going to be part of his cabinet? Is that what you're saying?
Well, think about it. Right now, Hillary Clinton, and I don't want to get into any bastion of any candidates, but Hillary Clinton and Ted Cruz, they're all part of the establishment, especially Hillary Clinton. And yet the value of the African-American net worth being at 5,000 has all been under her watch. And what's really drawn a lot of evangelicals and American voters to Donald Trump is he's coming from outside the political system. They come in and say, listen, I'm self-funding. I see what the problem is. And right now, the number one issue that we have in America is jobs.
And you've been to Trump rallies, Pastor Burns?
All over the country, yes. That's why my voice is hoarse right now.
Yeah, right, right. Are you among a lot of other African Americans at these rallies? When you look around, what kinds of people are at these rallies?
Well, right now, I think the rallies, you know, it is a mixture. It is still, as of right now, it's still predominantly Caucasian. But I can see every rally I go to, there are more and more and more African-Americans are standing up. And I'm going to tell you, let me say this. I speak to thousands of African-Americans in this country, black Americans in this country on a one-on-one basis. And many of them, almost most of that I've spoken to, one, don't believe Donald Trump is a racist. They don't believe that he is out to, you know, to create a white supremacist government, as others have said. They're almost closet supporters that are out there. And as I said many times before, there are more African-Americans that are privately supporting Donald Trump than you think, only because it's politically incorrect to be an African-American and support a Republican, especially one like Donald Trump. When you look at people like Jennifer Hudson in 2008, when she lost her mother and her brother in that horrific triple murder, it was Donald Trump who took up that tab, paid for those funeral arrangements. It was Donald Trump who created a fund, a college fund, for those children that were left behind. Now, they don't ever have to worry about college. He did this way before he was deciding to run for president.
Well, it's going to be a wild ride between now and November, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. It's still a battle. We haven't won yet. Again, I'm not officially with the campaign. I speak as myself. I just believe personally, as a Donald Trump supporter, he would be the best thing for the candidate, for the country, and the best thing for us as African Americans. We need jobs.
Well, we're going to keep your phone number handy. You don't mind if we call you again?
Absolutely. Be honored to.
Pastor Mark Burns is an evangelical pastor in South Carolina. Thanks so much.
Blessings to you.
Donald Trump received some support from the takeaway community, Oviedo, Florida. I'm not surprised that Trump has won so many states. People have been so fed up for so long that they are ready to have an un-PC voice come out to defend them in a manner that speaks to their heart. People are afraid of Trump for his lack of self-control, arrogance, and ego, but he'll probably win. Irving, Texas. It's clear Hillary Clinton will be the Democratic nominee. Because of that, I'm a registered independent who lives in Texas, so today I voted for Donald Trump. And when Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee officially and enters the general against Trump, I will vote for him again. I'm a Bernie Sanders supporter, and it hurt me so bad to vote Trump, but Hillary Clinton is a liar and another fake liberal like Barack Obama. Will it be Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump in the general election? She eked out a win in Massachusetts last night. Barney Frank is already looking ahead to the general election later this year. He's a former congressman from Massachusetts. He says Hillary's success is all about one particular voting bloc.
She's overwhelmingly likely to be the nominee, not simply because she won many more of the contests. There's a new slogan, I think, that's coming out of this set of primaries, although it's a reaffirmation of what's been true in Democratic primaries for president for a while. Black votes matter. African Americans are a large percentage of the Democrats, since they are overwhelmingly Democratic. The overwhelming percentage of black votes that Hillary Clinton received this time and in South Carolina means that she's going to do very well in primaries going forward, not just in the South, but in states like Michigan, Ohio, and other places where there's a significant black population.
Moving forward in the campaign, is Hillary Clinton vulnerable on her economic policy? She's linked to Wall Street. She takes contributions from Wall Street, and she's certainly linked to the Clinton administration, which did so much deregulation of the banks back in the 90s.
The single most important deregulation is something that Bernie Sanders voted for. She was not in the Congress at the time. I did vote for two. Several of us made that mistake, but it was the one that kept derivatives from being regulated. Bernie Sanders has a dilemma here. The more he criticizes Hillary Clinton for what he says is being soft on Wall Street, the harsher he's being towards Barack Obama. Bernie Sanders has an ad running that says, look at these bad things that various of these financial industries did, and look at the fact that they weren't punished strongly enough. That must be because people got speaking fees and campaign contributions. Well, that's an attack on Barack Obama. It has nothing to do with Hillary Clinton. She was not in a position to do anything. The Secretary of State, which she was, has no role in deciding what the penalty is for financial institutions. So, no, I don't think that you're going to see the Democrats in particular decide that, Obama was just terrible on this, and we'll vote for a guy who repudiates him.
Listen to this voter from Fauquier County, Virginia, who seems to express the point that maybe they're not seeing that this is a criticism of Barack Obama. They think that it's a criticism of Hillary Clinton.
I do not support Hillary. She's not for us. She's not for the people. Everything about her is very questionable.
You do remember that Virginia voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. I didn't say to you that no voter thinks that way. I am saying that I think the majority obviously don't agree with that, since she's won a great majority of the Democratic voters so far. Hillary Clinton had nothing to do with whether or not Goldman Sachs or Citicorp or anybody was penalized for past mistakes. That was Barack Obama. That was the Obama administration that made those decisions.
Former Democratic representative from Massachusetts, Barney Frank, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So now some voices from the Democratic wing of the Takeaway Party.
Bill Sparks, Springfield, Oregon. I always liked Hillary, although I do like Bernie. I appreciate him being in the race, and I think he pushed Hillary to new heights and a better message.
I was feeling the burn as I waited in a line more than a block long. Now I feel pretty good, having done my patriotic duty. Minneapolis.
Aram, I'm calling from Quincy, Mass, and Hillary will get my vote. I was not surprised by the result. It is hard to look at the U.S. as a world leader, having Donald Trump with no filter, racist, and with his ignorance. But however, I will go vote for Hillary.
Super Tuesday certainly stirred things up. We'd love to hear how you're feeling at this moment and the story that you're telling. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Now let's consider how the results of Super Tuesday are being absorbed in the Bernie Sanders camp. The former chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party, Philip Johnston, has long been a champion of the senator from Vermont. Philip Johnston joins us from our partner WGBH in Boston. Philip, welcome to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you.
So it appears that the Bernie Sanders message hasn't been absorbed very much outside of New England. How do you explain that?
Well, he did. That's not exactly right. He did very well in Colorado. Colorado and Minnesota, by the way. Colorado is probably the quintessential purple state, and he won that by 10 points. Minnesota, he did very well. Massachusetts, which really, you know, people say, well, it's close to Vermont, but we don't have, you know, we don't have all that much connection to Vermont. But it was very, very close, despite the fact that the entire political establishment in the state was arrayed or allied against him. So I think he did pretty well last night. And as you are no doubt aware, last month he raised $42 million, which I believe is a national record in any presidential campaign.
And he'll continue from this point on. And what's the scenario between here and the convention? Is it a knockdown dragout? Is it a principled fight over issues and then peace at the convention? What do you think is going to happen?
Peace. Well, there definitely is going to be peace at the convention. And I can assure you that this is going to be a united party. You know, this has not been a terribly divisive primary. There's no bitterness or anger that I can detect on either side. And I think those of us who are with Bernie have great regard for Hillary and vice versa. And when we come together in Philadelphia and we leave there with a nominee, we're going to be very united in taking on Donald Trump. But I think Bernie has been extremely, he's had a profound impact on the campaign and on the Democratic Party in terms of the issues that he's raised. In my particular case, I think the issues of economic inequity and the need for campaign finance reform are paramount. The campaign finance system that we have now, particularly with Citizens United, is totally corrupt and relies on the bankrolls of very wealthy people to fund these campaigns. And I think it fundamentally undermines democracy. So these are very important issues which he has put on the table. And I think they're very important not only for the Democratic Party, but for the entire nation.
Let's talk about a couple of things. You mentioned that he did well outside of New England, and you spoke about Colorado and Oklahoma. Oklahoma never votes.
And Minnesota.
Right. Let's talk about Oklahoma and Colorado, though. Oklahoma never votes Democratic, so it's hard to see how that is an advantage in the general
going
forward.
Well, South Carolina, yeah, but the southern states never vote Democratic either. The chances of winning South Carolina or Tennessee or Georgia are nil. And so purple states like Minnesota is now pretty much a purple state. Colorado, as I said earlier, is the classic purple state. He's doing very well in those states. And if you look at the national polling, he does better against Trump than Hillary does. So I think it's sort of a misplaced or wrong perception that many people have that he's weaker in these national matchups than his opponent is.
Well, let me tell you about some things that some of our listeners have been saying, that mm-hmm. they voted for Bernie, but they see Trump did so well on the Republican side that they're going to vote for Hillary in the general election, that somehow the specter of Donald Trump is so terrifying to them as progressive Democrats that they'll vote for Hillary Clinton. Now, you say the national polling favors Bernie, and I've seen those numbers, but this has really stirred things up in a way that it's very, very unexpected to see where we go from here.
Yeah, I think that Bernie has a message that's very powerful that cuts across ideological lines and class lines, and I think that were he to be the nominee, I think he'd be able to send that message in a powerful way around the country, and that it would resonate very strongly not only with Democrats, but you might notice that in most of these states he does very well among independents, and of course that's sort of a legacy that he had in Vermont. Look at those numbers in Vermont. So you look at these Republicans who are having trouble, some problems in their own states, like Marco Rubio. Bernie Sanders got 86% of the vote in a state that traditionally had been a Republican state. And many, many independents voted for him yesterday. And in the years that he's been in the Senate and before that in the House, he enjoyed very bipartisan support from not only Democrats, but independents and Republicans as well.
Do the superdelegates make Bernie Sanders' point that politics is run by people in the back rooms?
I never liked, even when I was party chair, I never liked the idea of having superdelegates. I think it ought to be one person, one vote. But, you know, this happened in 08 when Hillary was running against Obama, and most of the superdelegates were initially with Hillary. And when the voters made clear that they were supporting Barack Obama, those superdelegates switched to Obama. So I'm not concerned. I think that the people make a mistake when they add in the superdelegates in toting up the delegate count.
Well, we'll see what the strategy is from here on out, but a lot of exciting milestones coming up. Philip Johnston joined us from our partner station WGBH in Boston. He's a former chair of the Massachusetts Democratic Party. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
God bless Texas!
And Texas blessed Ted Cruz with a solid win last night in his home state of Texas. It was win in Texas or go home for Senator Cruz, but he's still a long way from the nomination. Victoria Coates is the foreign policy advisor for Ted Cruz's campaign. Senator Cruz needed Texas like nobody's business. Victoria, what now?
Well, I think it was a great victory in Texas, John. I mean, 17 points when everyone was writing his obituary 48 hours ago and saying that Trump was going to win the state. It wasn't even close. And with Marco not being able to get over 20%, I think you really see this race separating into a two-man battle. And that's where we have to focus our energies.
Does Marco Rubio have to get out of the race for Ted Cruz to have any chance?
Well, I mean, this is a democracy and all of our candidates run freely. Obviously, he doesn't have to do anything, but I think if you believe that Donald Trump is not the best thing for our nation, then you really have to give some hard thought into who can actually beat him. And Senator Cruz has proven resoundingly last night that he can.
What about the argument that if a majority of Republicans believe that Donald Trump is fine for the nation, then Ted Cruz is just going to have to stand aside?
Well, obviously, I mean, that is the case in our democracy, but we very much believe we have a clear path to victory. I mean, what he's saying is that he has very strong policy differences with Mr. Trump. That's what he wants to highlight. And that he believes that Senator Cruz, has a clear path to the nomination himself, and that's what he wants to pursue.
Why did Trump do so well, do you think?
It's been an incredible ride, I think, for Mr. Trump over the last 10 months. He's just tapped into a passionate vein of anger in the American people, particularly on economic issues, on feeling like their wages are stagnating, there isn't the opportunity that there has been, on foreign policy, which is obviously my area, where they feel like America is being mocked. So I don't think that this is now surprising. I mean, obviously, we couldn't have predicted it 10 months ago. But that's where we are. And the differences, though, that Senator Cruz wants to point out is how to solve these problems.
Finally, Victoria Coates, Hillary Clinton got a huge applause last night, as expected. It was her supporters, of course, in her speech where she said, "This isn't about making America great again. America has always been great. It's about, filling the holes and supplying an option for people who have been left behind." Do you think that's what this general election is going to be about, the debate between the Republicans who are saying America is not great and has to be made great again and that there's been a disaster under Barack Obama, and what the Democrats seem to be saying, which Americans are buying, and that is that it hasn't been a disaster. There's some fixing that has to be done, but America doesn't need to be made great again.
John, I think you're being very generous there. What she said was that America has to be made whole again. And again, last time I looked at a map, we were a whole sovereign nation. We haven't lost pieces. But it, I think, is, again, a difference with Mr. Trump. Senator Cruz has said this, that we are the greatest nation on the face of the earth. And what we need to do is get back to the principles that made us great. And that's something he obviously is quite expert in. I don't really understand how anyone could look at our current circumstances, economic and international, and say that we just need to sort of pick around the edges here, that everything's going swimmingly well. I mean, 6 weeks ago, we had our sailors on their knees with Iranian guns pointed at their heads. This is a disaster. The stock market is cratering. As I mentioned, wages are stagnating. This is not a good time. And to say, oh, we just need to patch it up a little bit, seems borderline delusional. So if that's her argument for the general, we're ready for that.
Victoria Coates is a foreign policy advisor for Ted Cruz and the author of David Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art. Thank you so much, Victoria.
Thank you, John. Take care.
A pause now in our breathless day after Super Tuesday political coverage. The Supreme Court will begin hearing oral arguments today in Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstadt. In 2013, the state legislature passed a law requiring abortion clinics to employ at least one doctor with admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. It was a law in Texas. Other more dangerous procedures don't have this restriction. Colonoscopies, for example, have a much higher mortality rate than abortions, and doctors performing them say they don't need to have admitting privileges. Texas legislators, though, insist the standards are necessary to protect women. It's an argument that constitutes a workaround of a constitutional principle that abortion under Roe v. Wade is still legal. Alice Kessler-Harris is a historian at Columbia University and says there is a long history of rationalizing female inequality with laws supposedly designed to protect women.
What the defendants are arguing is that women who get abortions are in need of protection by the state, and that the state needs to protect them from clinics that are not, in their view, adequately funded and equipped. And that it also needs to protect them from people who, in their view, are inadequate doctors. Now, we know from the medical community that these efforts to so-called protect women draw on the notion that women are in need of a kind of supervision or protection that has long gone by the wayside. And that for many women, there would be the need to travel hundreds of miles to get services which are perfectly legal and constitutional. And therefore, asking them to do this is an undue burden.
How does this particular case arise out of laws and practices and precedents that come really from the workplace?
It stems back to 1908, where a rather famous court case named Muller v. Oregon declared that women could, in fact, be protected at work. And the reason to protect them, the court says, is because they are the mothers of the race or the future mothers of the race, and that therefore the health and well-being of the next generation lay in their hands. And since that was the case, all of society had a stake in the general welfare of women. And under those circumstances, the state had a right to pitch in to limit the freedom of employers to exploit women, to work them too many hours a day or to work them until they were too tired and so on. Some women actually benefited from that protective labor legislation for a number of years in that they got shorter hours and so on. But in fact, the long-term effect was to limit women to certain kinds of jobs, which did not require this kind of legislative protection or where employers could handle legislative protection. So the short-term effects might seem to have been good for women, but the long-term effect was to deny women opportunity in the labor force.
Is the doctrine of treating women differently than men in the workplace outmoded now and would never apply in an actual workplace case, unlike this case?
It is outmoded now, and it has been outmoded since the late 1960s and early 1970s. When the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission made the decision that protective labor legislation for women only was in fact illegal or unconstitutional. And that decision has been long since upheld. So for the last 45 or 50 years, the idea of special protection for women in the workplace has given way to the notion that if workers need protection, then all workers need protection, not just female workers.
How does the Texas law take an outmoded doctrine and turn it into a tactic for advancing the cause of the anti-abortion movement and expect that to be upheld in the courts?
I think that outmoded doctrine, that is, that women need protection, is deeply ingrained in American law and culture. Stemming back to the 18th century, the notion was that women, especially married women, came under the cover of their fathers or their husbands, that they were not persons in their own right, and that they were better represented by the male heads of families. And that notion, even though we've eliminated it in most of our laws, is nevertheless deeply ingrained in American culture. It took all of the 1970s and many Supreme Court cases for laws to be changed so that women didn't have to live where their husbands lived, so that they could legally change their names and or not change their names and continue to use their own names. Despite the fact that the laws have now changed, there's still a kind of sense that manliness or masculinity resides in a male's capacity to support a family. And if that can't happen, then what will a man be? What will a family be? So though we've changed the laws, there's a little bit, I think, of our cultural heritage that still persists in identifying women as weaker, more dependent, less able to support themselves, less able to make judgments for themselves. And it's that bit, I think, that's reflected in the Texas laws.
Alice Kessler-Harris is author of Out to Work, A History of Wage-Earning Women in the United States. She's professor of American history at Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back to your reactions to Super Tuesday, Miami, Florida. I feel great. A Trump candidacy gives me hope that a new, smarter, moderate, independent party will emerge from the ashes of the Republican Party. Let's call the new party the American Party. It will put the country first.
This is Laurie Williams in Austin, Texas. Results from Super Tuesday are making me feel worse. Trump scares me. You can't pin him down on anything. He takes umbrage at any criticism, and he riles up hateful crowds. I voted for Bernie. I am not a millennial. I am the mother of two adult millennials who are both staunch Democrats, religious, and caring, just like both of their parents.
Tell us your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or leave us a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Passion, cynicism, joy, anger, we've heard it all this hour. Farai today is senior writer for 538 and author of The Episodic Career. Farai, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks, John.
Let's get some hard numbers to add to all those feelings. We've had Barney Frank and an African-American pastor both say that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump will be the nominees. What do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, at this point, there was a funny viral Washington Post graphic using this ethical paradox, the prisoner's dilemma, but applying it to the GOP. So basically what it means is that if neither Rubio nor Cruz drop out, and neither of them seems particularly likely to, because Rubio won one race yesterday, Cruz won two, Trump's got a clear path. I mean, you know, unless he self-destructs. And I've always said since the beginning of this race that Trump was Trump's only Trump killer. Because the mood of the American electorate is deeply tied to cynicism about the American economy and the future of the American dream. And there's actually sort of this arc where Sanders voters and Trump voters have a lot in common in terms of their beliefs about where America is and the fact that we need a radical change. They just disagree on everything else.
Right. And the failings of the two-party system, the fringes of both of those movements attract Bernie and Donald Trump. But can Donald Trump hold them long haul? You know, he's managed to resist any, you know, sort of downside poll reaction to a lot of his comments. And I just wonder what it is that he will do to self-destruct at this point, if he hasn't already done it.
Well, I mean, first of all, we haven't seen his tax returns. There are increasing ethical questions about some of his business practices, including hiring undocumented laborers, what Trump University is or isn't in terms of actually being a real university for the people who pay money to go there. And then I also think, you know, he's got a mouth on him, and he could say more clanny things or other, you know, things that really inspire the ire of Republican voters, because that's really who matters. But I think he is the likely nominee. All the results yesterday tell us that, except for these three races that were won by Cruz or Rubio, he took the table. And also the spirit and the mood of the Republican electorate right now is very much focused on getting an outsider. And Cruz used to be considered an outsider. He's now considered practically an establishment candidate by the electorate, not by politicians. You know, people in Congress really, I don't know if despise is the right word. Some of them
Lindsey
truly
Graham,
despise.
Lindsey Graham told Todd Zwillick just a moment ago that maybe we'll have to support Cruz. So, yes, there is some distance between the establishment on Capitol Hill and Ted Cruz.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, I think that Trump, I'd like to see his tax returns. But I also think that we've entered a phase where we have to point a finger at ourselves, the media, where I'm not saying you or I, but we as a herd treated Trump as a celebrity and not as a candidate early in the race, which allowed him to set up something where he is getting you know, 10 times as much free media as any of his competitors. And so that is something, I mean, if we believe advertising works, and we always talk about the Super Bowl ads, and we believe that ads can sell cereal, he basically has been using us, the media, as free advertising. And so I think we have to really look at the way that he disrupted this race. He fundamentally disrupted the concept of the role that journalists play in vetting politicians.
Many, many listeners have said that they voted for Bernie today, but when they saw Trump's success on the Republican side, their fear of him being the nominee and possibly making it to the White House means they're going to vote for Hillary. So Trump's success helps Hillary. Did the numbers say anything like that?
Well, there have been matchups, like CNN did a recent matchup of a Trump-Hillary race, and Clinton won decisively in that matchup, whereas she was breaking even against Cruz or Rubio. So there's evidence that Clinton actually does far better against Trump than she would against either of the two other viable candidates at this point. And, you know, there's so much evidence about the changing electorate, too. You know, so, for example, in 2012, you had a 3.8% victory for President Obama. Now, Romney did the best with non-college educated whites, but those are decreasing as a percentage of the American electorate as we become more diverse. So there'll be 3% less, you know, non-college educated whites as a total of the electorate. Asian Americans will rise to 4% of the electorate from 3%. Hispanics will rise by 2% from 10% to 12%. African Americans pretty much break even. And so you don't see a lot of messaging from the Trump camp really courting the diverse electorate. So America is becoming more diverse. Trump is going for, people who are white voters with economic anxiety and often with racial resentment. There's a lot of actual hard evidence that Trump voters tend to have racial resentment that is tied into their economic anxiety. And he's doing really well. I think that will continue to do him well in the primary process, but I don't really see it manifesting in the general. And in fact, I did with the new book I have out, The Episodic Career, which is about the future of jobs. I did a bunch of extensive survey research, and I did some results that I didn't even publish in the book, which showed that Trump voters were the least hopeful about the future of America. But Sanders voters, interestingly, were the most confused. They were the ones who said, I don't know if America has a bright future. And so I think that those two, again, those two represent different manifestations of the same anxiety.
Is Hillary Clinton a safety vote then? I mean, she's very establishment.
Yeah.
If you're angry about the establishment, you know, she's Hillary Clinton. But is Trump so disruptive that it tips the balance in favor of Hillary Clinton in some sense?
Well, you still have two very different electorates, where the Democratic electorate tends to be much more in favor of establishment candidates, especially African Americans who have long had a vested interest in having powerful allies in the White House. And the GOP electorate is saying we want an outsider. And when you mash that up in the general election, that'll be the fight as to what people want. But right now you're seeing very different desires from different sides.
Fascinating stuff. Farhad Shaddai, a senior writer for 538. That must be a fun job right now.
It is fun.
Yes, indeed. Author of The Episodic Career. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
And here's something to take with you. It's kind of like a science fiction movie. A man goes into space for 340 days and then lands in Kazakhstan, opens his eyes, and the Earth has totally changed. Okay, not the whole Earth, just the U.S. election campaign.
You know, leaving the space station was bittersweet. You know, I've been there a long time, so I look forward to leaving. But at the same time, you know, it's a magnificent place, and I'm going to miss it. So, you know, mixed emotions, I guess.
American Scott Kelly just returned to Earth yesterday after 340 days at the International Space Station. He spoke with The Takeaway during his time in space.
You know, we put this thing together while hurtling around the Earth at 17,500 miles an hour in a vacuum, in extremes of temperature and this radiation environment. You know, how we do things is just a testament, I think, to the ingenuity of us as a species.
NASA officials say they are going to wait a few days to tell Kelly about how Donald Trump won Super Tuesday. Just kidding. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.